North Korea's Kim Jong-un has bid for a diplomatic gold medal at the Winter Olympics in South Korea. The main segment of today's podcast is about the possible consequences for the two Koreas and the exchange of nuclear threats between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. First, we'll touch base with Steve Call. He's dean of the Columbia Journalism School, staff writer for The New Yorker. His 25 years of reporting have made him a leading authority on America's longest war, the conflict in Afghanistan. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Ghost Wars, and he's on tour with the sequel. I asked him what's one question he anticipated but that nobody has asked.
Well, I think why did the Obama administration struggle with this war so badly is really at the heart of a good part of the narrative. And it's a complicated subject, I think an important one, because it's part of the Obama administration's legacy that hasn't really received as much attention as it might. You know, the president's foreign policy record includes achievements like the Iran nuclear accord and the reversal of decades of policy toward Cuba, but it also includes this mess in Afghanistan and also, in Syria. And I think the story of how this Nobel Peace Prize winning president inherited a war, escalated a war, and then left a muddle behind is important. It doesn't blot out the legacy of Barack Obama as president, but the story of how it happened is a cautionary lesson, I think, for future presidents, and one that still informs our struggle in Afghanistan today.
You say he inherited the war, but he also inherited the mess, did he not?
The war was deteriorating when he came in. He had also campaigned in 2008, pledging to fix Afghanistan as the war that America should have been focused on as opposed to Iraq. So he had kind of made a political bargain with the electorate that he was going to turn his attention to this war. And then he came in, found the war deteriorating, also found that he was under pressure to act quickly because there was an election scheduled in the summer of 2009, a presidential election in Afghanistan. The Pentagon came into his office right away and said, you know, Mr. President, you need to put more troops in to secure this vote. And before he had really even settled in, he was already making these highly consequential decisions about escalating the war. And he had divided advice. Richard Holbrook and Joe Biden, two of his most influential civilian advisors, cautioned him about the kind of Vietnam syndrome. Holbrook had served in Vietnam. And you had this dynamic where the president really found Holbrook too self-dramatizing, irritating, and he dismissed this comparison to Vietnam. And as I was researching the book, I went back through conversations I'd had with Holbrook at the time before his death in 2010. And he was recounting to me in one of them about how he had irritated the president by comparing the situation to Vietnam. And he said to me, they shouldn't be so afraid of history, which resonates now, because the parallels to the trap of Vietnam and the illusions of the Vietnam War are perhaps more evident now than they were in 2009.
One of the fascinating things about this book is the relationships between the players, many of whom you got to talk to, and I think probably in combinations that other people haven't been able to talk to. But let me ask, let our listeners hear you say what the title of the book is and then explain why it is what it is.
So the title of the book is Directorate S, The Secret History of the CIA, the CIA's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Directorate S refers to the covert action arm of the Pakistani Intelligence Service, ISI, which the U.S. got to know through the CIA in the 1980s when the U.S. collaborated with Directorate S to thwart the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan and really pumped a lot of money into ISI and built it up into a state within the state. And what happened, one part of what happened to the U.S. in Afghanistan is that ISI ran the same playbook against the United States in Afghanistan that the CIA and ISI had run against the Soviet Union, clandestinely supporting the Taliban's revival as an instrument of Pakistani influence in its neighboring country. And the United States was slow to recognize this, even though it was well-schooled in ISI's methodology, and it really didn't see what was going on until 2007 or so, at which point the war was really sliding fast and proved very difficult to reverse.
How did Directorate S come to exist, and what's its principal function?
It came to exist because Pakistan sees India as an existential threat and feels the weaker party in this rivalry, smaller population, smaller industrial base, and has used guerrilla war, especially Islamist ideology, as a way to keep India off balance as part of its struggle with India. And so it built these militias up initially, as we talked about, to defeat the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, but then it quickly adapted that method in Kashmir and in other venues where it felt these militias could level the playing field with a much more powerful rival, India. India is, of course, has a large Muslim population. It feels vulnerable to the unleashing of radical viruses in its minority Muslim population. And terrorism has been part of Pakistan's strategy, frankly, with India.
What about al-Qaeda? What about the infamous bomber of September 11th? Your book actually begins on September 11th, 2001. The previous one ended on September 10th. How did he get to the compound where we ultimately discovered Osama bin Laden? And what does it tell us that he got there at all? And was it a good idea to go take him out?
Well, he got there because he escaped into Pakistan during the war in the fall of 2001.
We let that happen?
Well, it was a missed opportunity, yes. I mean, we didn't intentionally let it happen, but it happened because we did not plan for the possibility that he would seek to move east into Pakistan. He was up on this mountainside, Tora Bora, where the U.S. Sent these Delta forces to kind of try to spot him. They overheard him on the radio, and there was a debate that's recounted in the book about whether to put a blocking force up on the mountain to try to prevent him from escaping into Pakistan. They had discussions about that within the U.S. military command. They had discussions about that with the Pakistanis. The Pakistanis said, hey, we'd be happy to send a blocking force up there. We don't want these people in our country, but we need helicopters. We don't have the capability to lift infantry up there fast enough. And the Americans said, well, we don't have any helicopters either. You go back over why they didn't move, and part of it was logistics, but part of it was also fear that they had that they might provoke an uprising if they put American soldiers on these in these tribal areas. And it was a little bit of over-interpreting the Soviet experience in Afghanistan, this kind of worry that they were going to be vulnerable to a Black Hawk Down scenario if they put soldiers up there. In any event, they didn't do it. He escaped into Pakistan. Okay, what happened to him? There've been pretty good records and investigations done from multiple sources about his time in exile in Pakistan. My reading of the record is that there were about 6 months where it wasn't really clear where he was. He seemed to have gone north along the border to escape, but he surfaces around the city of Peshawar in Pakistan about 6 months after he escaped. One of his younger wives joins him. He finds a house there. They have a child. The child is born in some kind of Pakistani clinic. Eventually, he moves houses a couple of times, and around 2005 or 2006, he moves into this big compound in Abbottabad that has been built for him by a couple of Pakistani Kuwaitis who are serving as essentially his bodyguard, his staff, and he's given them money. They have salaries. They watch out for him. They get his groceries. They manage his affairs. And they build this house, and he moves into it and hunkers down there until he's killed in 2011.
We've heard so much about how he was right down the street, as it were, from the ISI. Were they, in fact, or was he, in fact, in their custody or in the custody of Directorate S, or do we know?
I couldn't find positive evidence that the Pakistanis knew he was in that house. They continue to claim that they didn't. I find it entirely plausible that they did know he was there. If you read all of the letters that were captured in his house and later declassified, translated, he's always writing to his sons who are trying to come join him in Abbottabad. And he's very worried that they're going to run into the Pakistani police. He's writing them all the time, you know, watch out, don't come on this day, you know, don't go through that guy. He has too many connections to the Pakistani security services. So that's one body of evidence. There's another bit of testimony from his wife about once when they moved houses, they drove in a little minibus and there was a Pakistani policeman in the vehicle. Okay, so what's that? So it's not dispositive. I think part of what cautions me about, you know, absolutely concluding that they did know, you know, some other journalists have quoted anonymous sources claiming that the Pakistanis did know, and I find that they're credible journalists. That's entirely plausible. I just didn't come up with that insight myself. And one thing that cautions me is that after 2011, there was enormous hostility toward Pakistan in the U.S. system, in the U.S. intelligence system. They really saw Pakistan as an enemy that had cost Americans lives and misery in the Afghan war. And if they had evidence that bin Laden was being hidden by Pakistan, if they had that evidence, I think it would have leaked. There would have been a way to put more pressure on Pakistan. And you can see the administration trying to do that. So I'm afraid it's I don't have a clear answer, but I my job, I felt, was to just give you the best evidence on both sides that I could.
Commendable thing to do, but it seems to me surprising, given all the contacts that you have, and you have been dealing with this area since 1989, I think. It's a long time, and a lot of people know you, and you've talked to people on both sides, or all sides, I should say, because you can't say both sides in a situation like this. It's still surprising to me that you're unable to come up with a definite answer. Do you think it'll ever be known?
It might be. It depends on where the if there is evidence of greater collaboration than what we already understand. The question is, where does that evidence reside? And it's possible that there were, for example, Pakistani officers, military or intelligence officers, who might have known about the accommodation of Osama bin Laden and then defected to the United States, and their identities have been kept secret in order to protect their lives or their families. Sometimes when that has happened in history, we don't know about those sources until much later. That's a possibility. It's possible that the United States acquired classified documents from the compound that it hasn't yet released that do show this, and they just haven't leaked. I find that surprising if true, but you know, you can't rule it out. And you know, there was a lot of assumption that the CIA had worked very closely with Osama bin Laden during the 1980s. That was an assumption as well. And when I researched Ghost Wars, I came to the conclusion that really, no, they had not had direct contact with him, except, you know, maybe once or twice in a very light conversational sense. They were not partners. They were indirect partners. They were in effect facilitating his rise, but they were not direct partners. And that assertion has held up, I think, even on the al-Qaeda side. They don't really, you know, they don't claim that they were partners of the CIA. They worked with intermediaries that the CIA worked with. But, you know, sometimes history is more complicated than you assume.
Indeed. It takes 600 pages just to explain what happened since 2001. So Pakistan's a relatively young country, and it was a pretty thriving democracy at some point. Now it appears to be divided between political side and the military side. How did that come to be, and does that have to do with Islam?
It has to do partly with the competition to control the story of Pakistan between the military and the civilian elites, and Islam is part of the story of Pakistan. So in that sense, yes. You know, Pakistan's founder died soon after independence, and the vision of a constitutional democracy that he had laid out for the country never really consolidated the way it did in India, where, you know, Nehru survived for, you know, 15 plus years after independence. So there was always a back and forth between the army and the civilians. Then there were three wars with India in which Pakistan was defeated, but the net effect of such an environment was to empower the military, strengthen the military's position. And then in the 1980s, when the Pakistan army collaborated with the CIA and Saudi Arabia to build up these Islamist militias in Afghanistan, the kind of idea of using political Islam as an ideology, as a way to challenge India, and also as an instrument of kind of the army's control inside Pakistan began to develop. And I think, you know, it's a complicated environment even still. Pakistan has a very large middle class. It has a growing economy. It has a strong civil society. The army has been repressive, relatively speaking, over the last 5 or 6 years, partly to restore security after a period of domestic terrorism and partly to maintain indirect power while letting a notional civilian government rule. But the country has grown and developed. If it weren't so badly ruled by the army and by ISI, I think it would be, you know, a very significant contributor to the international system. And it still has that potential, but it has trapped itself in these alliances with these radical groups and in this dead-end policy of using violent militias as an instrument of influence in the region. And until the army either gives up that strategy or is forced to yield to civilian leaders who don't want to pursue that strategy, I'm afraid the country will remain mired in these cycles of self-defeating cycles.
So there's a lot of concern in this country that Pakistan has been as helpful as it has to the Taliban and to the Haqqani Network and other so-called terrorist organizations. President Trump has said that he would like to reduce the amount of money that the United States gives in aid to Pakistan. Is that going to help? Is that going to change things in Afghanistan?
I'm doubtful that it will change Pakistan's conduct. I can certainly understand the frustration was expressed by the Trump administration and certainly was felt by the Obama administration that we're spending all of this, providing all of this assistance to the Pakistan army, and then they're not doing what they might to reduce the violence in Afghanistan by pressuring the Taliban that are on their soil. The problem is twofold. One, Pakistan is a fiercely nationalistic country that doesn't respond well to being shamed in public or pressured. We've used sanctions in the past to try to change their conduct. It hasn't worked. And maybe even more importantly, Pakistan's most important ally in the world is China, has been for decades. China is now a much stronger and richer country than it was even in the 90s, the last time we tried to sanction Pakistan. And I see Pakistan kind of nesting itself in its relationship with China as a way to outlast and evade the pressure that the U.S. is going to put on. Now, we'll see if the U.S. continues to escalate this kind of pressure. It may have also blowback in Afghanistan with Pakistan using its clients to escalate the war there. So this is I think this is a slightly unstable moment. But I don't see pressure alone without some kind of negotiation, without some kind of diplomacy attached to it, likely to change much.
So the question is, who do you negotiate with? And people have said there's no military solution in Afghanistan. Should the Trump administration, should its allies, should somebody begin negotiating with the Taliban?
Well, the Obama administration carried out a 2.5-year secret negotiation with the Taliban's political commission that's chronicled in the book. And it's a fascinating story. It's never really been fully told. And it failed, though for peculiar reasons, partly to do with the estrangement between the United States and Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, but partly for a reason that would be complicated if it were attempted again today, which is the relationship between the Taliban and ISI, the Pakistani intelligence service. The Taliban negotiator kept saying to the Americans, "We're independent. We're Afghans. We don't want the ISI to be our agent. We don't want them to be our representative in these talks. We want to talk to you directly." And the Americans said, "Okay, well, let's talk directly." But the ISI wanted in. They wanted to influence these negotiations, to have a seat at the table, to negotiate for the Taliban. And the Americans recognized that any sustainable arrangement that came out of these talks was going to have to include Pakistan, but they wanted to stage it. Let's figure out what we can do with the Taliban first, and then we'll bring the Pakistanis into the picture later. So that whole kind of lessons learned history is available to the Trump administration. I think, you know, if you're listening to what they're saying, they are saying that they don't see a purely military solution in the war against the Taliban. They recognize that a purpose of military action is to try to set the stage for a negotiation later. But this has been American policy for a decade, and it hasn't moved the needle. We had 150,000 international combat troops in the country at the peak of the Obama escalation. We've got 10 or 15,000 in there now. The Afghan forces fight in the lead, but they're riddled with desertion, problems of illiteracy, factionalism in the security forces. Some of their forces are very effective and motivated, others less so. So it's hard to see how military progress is on the battlefield is really going to change. The history of these kinds of wars is they can last a long time. And the history of them is that they end only with these kinds of secret talks and negotiations, whether that was, you know, the bargain with the FARC in Colombia that just ended a 40-year war, or the negotiations between...
Maybe, temporarily.
And the negotiations between, Britain and the Irish Republican Army. And I think when you look back at those kinds of negotiations in different settings around the world, you have to see that maintaining contact is important. You have to at least keep talking while you're fighting and look for an opportunity to try to reduce the violence.
It seems to me that we talk journalistically, and it seems to me in terms of public diplomacy as well, very simplistically about what's going on in this area. What your book illustrates to me is that this is a multidimensional puzzle, and it's really hard just to find your way around in it to figure out what solutions there might be. Are we fated, do you think, to have this continue for a long period of time? Is it going to cost us a lot of money in lives and in treasure?
I fear, certainly through the end of this administration, I don't see a change of course. This is a case of, you know, doing the same thing, really, that the Obama administration and the Bush administration did, with some variations on the theme, and expecting a different result. And I'm skeptical that we'll get one.
So good to have you on our podcast. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren. Good to see you.
Now to the Winter Olympics and the uneasy diplomacy between North and South Korea. In the midst of angry exchanges with President Trump about using nuclear weapons, North Korea's Kim Jong-un had a surprise in store. He sent athletes to the Winter Olympics in South Korea. The two Koreas even formed a unified women's hockey team. More amazing still, Kim Jong-un sent his younger sister, Kim Yo-jong, on a diplomatic mission. Jean Lee founded the Associated Press Bureau in Pyongyang, that's North Korea's capital city. She's now a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and she joins us from Pyeongchang, where the Olympics are being held.
Not to be confused with Pyongyang, which people are doing. Thanks for having me.
Okay, I take it it's cold enough for the Winter Olympics.
It is cold enough for it is a little bit too cold for the Winter Olympics, possibly the coldest Winter Olympics we've had in a while.
You've been to North Korea a good deal and began an Associated Press bureau there. What is the background of what Kim Jong-un calls an effort to have a warm climate of reconciliation and dialogue?
Yeah, this was a sudden turn of events. You know, we've had a year, more than a year, years really, of tensions here in this region, particularly in the past year with nuclear tests and ballistic missile tests. But, you know, on January 1st, which is the day when the leader of North Korea issues a speech that sets the tone for everything from domestic policy to foreign policy, he extended a bit of an olive branch and praised South Korea for the upcoming Olympics and indicated that he wanted to take part. And that set in motion this flurry of negotiations with South Korea to get the North Koreans involved in these Olympics. I should point out that this is something that the South Koreans have been working on behind the scenes for a long time. The South Korean president did want to make sure to have the North Koreans at these games. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One, he does want these games to be peaceful and to stand for some sort of emblem of what the games can accomplish in terms of, as you said, diplomacy. But also he needed the reassurance that there wouldn't be any provocations in this region. If you have North Koreans here, that certainly decreases the likelihood that there's going to be some sort of attack on South Korea, which was a major concern for many of the athletes and delegations participating in these Olympics.
Well, let me introduce Catherine Moon. She is chair of the Asian Studies Department at Wellesley College. She's also a veteran student of all things Korean. She, too, has been to those countries many times. And thank you for being on our program.
Hi there.
Tell us more about the South and how this peace offensive has been received there, not just by the administration of the country, but by the people.
The South Korean people have had a mixed response. On the one hand, the overwhelming majority of them supported North Korean participation in the games, but the overwhelming majority over the last month of negotiations prior to the opening games did not want a unified team to enter together, and the overwhelming majority did not want a unified athletic team. And as we know, the women's ice hockey team of South Korea was forced, in a sense, to join forces with their northern sisters and play as one team. So the South Koreans did not want that, and the South Koreans did not want a unification flag and a unified entrance to the opening ceremony. And the reasons are this, that many South Koreans feel that substantively nothing has changed in terms of North Korea's belligerent stance. And also, why is South Korea bending over backwards to accommodate North Korea, to feature North Korea, when the game is hosted, funded by the South Koreans, and it's supposed to be about celebrating South Korea's economic, political, cultural power? I find it interesting, in response to what Jean said about North Koreans wanting to participate in the Olympics, and that Kim Jong-un had actually stated this initiative in the New Year's address. If we read the New Year's address by Kim, it's an interesting document. It actually wants to claim the Olympics as North Korean. And in the document of January 1st, he basically states that this will be our Olympics. This will be Korean Olympics. He doesn't say South Korean Olympics. He doesn't say North Korean Olympics. And I found that really fascinating, that basically he's getting a free ride.
Gene Lee, back to you. Is this in any sense, do you think, a reaction to the exchanges that have gone on between Kim Jong-un and President Trump? Are the North Koreans nervous that they might have gone too far?
I think Washington would certainly like to see it that way, and to suggest that the campaign of maximum pressure has worked. And I do think that sanctions will pinch. But I personally believe that this is a plan that has been that was hatched years ago. And this is partly because, you know, I've been traveling to North Korea as a reporter, as a journalist over the years, and I've seen little bits and pieces and evidence that this has been on the minds of the strategists in North Korea, was how can we get involved in these games? How can we take advantage of the spotlight that is going to be on this region that is really just across the border? And remember that 30 years ago, when South Korea hosted the Seoul Olympics, the North Koreans had the same strategy, the same idea. How can we get involved in these Olympics? But their strategy was different. What they did was try to negotiate participation. When that fell apart, Kim Jong-il decided, hey, okay, well then I'm going to get the world's attention and try to distract from these games and bomb a Korean air flight. That ended up killing 115 people. It's absolutely fascinating because one of the bombers survived. She tried to take her cyanide pill, but did not succeed. So we do have her version of events. And so that was another, 30 years ago, another attempt by the North Koreans to take part in these Olympics that did not go so well. So I have seen over the years, North Korea's sort of careful planning to make sure that they could take advantage of the spotlight that has been focused on this region. I do also think that some of the provocations are part of that. It's a really savvy game they're playing. If you make it seem like this region is under threat with nuclear weapons, with the threat of war, that you are essentially putting South Korea in the position that if you swoop in at the last minute and say, hey, we can promise you some peace as long as you let us participate, but if you're Seoul, you're going to have no choice but to accept those terms. So I don't think it's as simple as just maximum pressure. I think that it's part of a much bigger strategy on the part of the North Koreans.
So, Catherine Moon, that explains a lot of what you said, I think, about the way the South Koreans are reacting, I take it, with a great deal of skepticism.
Yeah, and if I could add to Jean's thoughtful observations, I can speak on the policy aspects of this, which is that North Korea marches to its own drum, its own beat. So no matter how much Mr. Trump or anybody else threatens North Korea, they set their plan, they set their agenda, they will adapt accordingly, but those are just tactical adaptations. And in my view, the reason why, one of the many reasons why, actually, the North Koreans have chosen to take this moment to enter the international stage and conduct this so-called charm offensive, peace offensive, is this, that Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, back at the end of 2017, already declared publicly that he is satisfied with the stage of nuclear technology and nuclear missile advancement that the country had achieved. He said, it's complete. And that was a signal that he would want to focus on the other half of his main policy, which is called Pyongjin in South Korean. It means parallel development, parallel progress, or parallel advancement. And the other side of the military advancement is economic development. North Koreans direly need economic development, and the Kim Jong-un regime knows that, seriously knows that. And over the years, the North Korean elites have been preparing their countrymen and women for the idea of advancing everything from consumer products in terms of quality and quantity and accessibility, better run distribution systems, so-called markets, and also access to making money. North Koreans want to make money. North Korea right now is basically the best laboratory to see raw capitalism at work. It is not the kind of closed-off state that so many people assume it is. And so for Kim Jong-un, I think he is trying to flirt with South Korea and other countries possibly to see how much economic advantage and economic planning that he would be able to benefit from in the maybe near midterm, long-term future. And then that requires a lifting or modification of sanctions.
Very interested to hear what you say about what Kim Jong-un said about the nuclear program, that it's complete and that enough has been done. Here's Vice President Pence, who, of course, was at the games, although briefly, and famously refused to even look at, let alone shake hands with, Kim Yo-jong.
Allow me to just assure you and the people of South Korea that the United States of America will continue to stand shoulder to shoulder in our effort to bring maximum pressure to bear on North Korea until that time comes when they finally and permanently and irreversibly abandon their nuclear and ballistic missile ambitions.
So, Jean Lee, back to you. We don't see any sense of gratitude on the part of the United States for Kim Jong-un saying that his nuclear program is complete.
I just want to put Pence's behavior into context, not to defend it, because it certainly was controversial here in South Korea. South Koreans were a bit offended by his behavior. But, you know, the North Koreans and the Americans are technically still at war. And so he was under orders to come here and to show support for Team USA, but also for South Korea. I'm sure he was not happy that he was in such close proximity with the North Koreans. But if he was, he needed to show that they weren't going to provide the North Koreans with any propaganda that would show him interacting with the North Korean leadership. But he also needed to show that he was still closely aligned and in close contact with President Moon Jae-in. So he did have that objective. And what we did see was that kind of frostiness. It was awfully cold inside that ice rink, and not because of the ICE. But we did hear, obviously, as you mentioned, as he left, that perhaps the United States would be a bit more open than he indicated to engage with the North Koreans. However, in those comments, he said they need to put denuclearization on the table. And that is going to be a red line for the North Koreans. And that is where we're going to start to see the difficulty in any kind of negotiations between the United States and North Korea, and of course North Korea and any of the United States partners. The weapons are something that the North Koreans do not want to give up. And denuclearization is going to be that tricky red line for the North Koreans.
Why should the North Koreans denuclearize when they see themselves as essentially under assault from the South, from Japan, with not all that much help from China? And, of course, we at one time had nuclear weapons on the ground pointed in their direction. Doesn't Kim Jong-un look at the situation just like it was for Muammar Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein?
You know, I would say that for the North, the nuclear issue is not going to go on the table. If it does, it's going to be on the U.S.'s table. It won't be on, we'll be at two different tables. And this has been a problem for many administrations, the Bush administration under George W., Obama, and now Trump, that you cannot start a dialogue when you demand that the other side give up what it thinks is its most valuable asset. So I think that there are some savvy American diplomats who have been working hard. They are not in the White House, they're in the State Department, who have been working hard to try to get the North Koreans to just simply start a dialogue and then to figure out what can go on that table that is of mutual interest and concern, and then eventually, hopefully, over time, building trust, building cooperation, get some kind of agreement on a freeze or some other aspect of controlling the advancement of nuclear technology. But North Koreans are not going to give up their nuclear arsenal completely. That's just a given.
Absolutely.
That many experts in Washington know, no matter what they say. They know it's taboo to say it, but everybody who actually has a brain knows this. I also want to get back to Mr. Pence, because I think Jean is right on in terms of the political reasons why Pence put on such an ice-cold face. But I do think that he did make a big faux pas in terms of sitting down when the rest of the stadium was up in arms cheering the entrance
Indeed.
Of the South Korean and North Korean athletes. And number one, Asians take etiquette so seriously. And it was just simply rude to be sitting down when your host country's athletes are walking in. He could have just simply stood up along with his wife. He didn't even have to clap. But it looked so arrogant the way he and his wife just sat down, basically looking pretty smug, while the rest of the world, in a sense, were in a celebratory mood. And it made the president of South Korea look bad because he is their host, the Pence's host.
Did even the South Koreans feel that way, do you think? You know them very well.
South Koreans have an historical sensitivity to the United States. On the one hand, South Koreans have rhetorically always said they're grateful for the military assistance that the U.S. gave and the lost lives sacrificed in the Korean War against communist North Korea and communist China back in the 50s. However, South Koreans are also sick and tired of the 60 plus years of what they feel is American arrogance around the U.S. military bases in South Korea, around U.S. the U.S. taking the lead on so many policy issues that are so dear to the existence of South Korea. So what President Moon has been doing very, very strategically is not only lining up North Korea to join the Olympics this time to guarantee a smoother experience, a smoother event, peaceful event, but also he has been positioning himself and his state, his nation state, into the main driver's seat of inter-Korean relations, and to put it right on the global map, on TV, on our screens, to make it clear that South Korea cannot be bypassed by the United States when it comes to dealing with North Korea.
Okay, that's Catherine Moon at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Let me go back to Jean Lee, who is in Seoul. How did the South Koreans react when Vice President Pence failed to stand up?
South Koreans were offended, as Kathy noted, and it certainly doesn't help the U.S., the attitude toward the U.S. here in South Korea. Remember, I just want to add to what Kathy was saying, the younger generation here feels very differently toward the United States than their parents and grandparents. They don't feel that sense of gratitude as much, and that's just because they've grown up in a different South Korea. They've grown up in a democratic South Korea. They don't remember the war. They didn't live through it. They grew up in a South Korea that is economically developed. And so they have very different priorities and a very different attitude toward the United States. And that's something, certainly that attitude doesn't play well here in South Korea. The Trump administration is not particularly popular among that demographic, and this certainly made them less popular. What I think it showed me was this inflexibility, and that really concerned me. I understand why he behaved the way he did, but I was disappointed because that kind of inflexibility does not augur well for any upcoming or potential negotiations with North Korea. You do need to be open-minded as well as strategic, but to behave that way suggests that you just don't have the ability to negotiate.
Let us hear a bit from the President of the United States during his State of the Union address on January 30th. That was before the so-called peace offensive that we're talking about by Kim Jong-un in advance of the Winter Olympics.
North Korea's reckless pursuit of nuclear missiles could very soon threaten our homeland. We are waging a campaign of maximum pressure to prevent that from ever happening. Past experience has taught us that complacency and concessions only invite aggression and provocation.
So, Gene Lee, back to you. Again, you've spent a lot of time in North Korea. You set up the Associated Press Bureau there. How do you think that's received? That sounds like not just business as usual, but somewhat advanced from what it used to be by President Trump, who really has made some threats, including very specific threats, it seems to me, to respond with nuclear weapons if, in fact, the North were to strike with a nuclear weapon. Do you think the North has any intention of doing such a thing? Kim Jong-un has said he will have the capacity to do it, but would you be astonished and amazed if, in fact, he did?
The intention to have the capacity is certainly different than the intention to strike. I don't think that they want another war of any kind. This is more about trying to ensure the survival of not only the country, but also the Kim leadership. And so he's using nuclear weapons both to protect his country and also to legitimize his place at the top of that totem pole. And I have to say that the year of rhetoric from the White House, from that Twitter feed, from the president's Twitter feed, has only helped Kim Jong-un's cause. What he needed was the justification or the excuse to continue pouring money into his nuclear program. And frankly, the president gave it to him. That said, any test that we have going forward is going to be aggressive and dangerous. And that is precisely why we need to have these negotiations now.
Catherine Moon, do you think that the South Koreans are just as worried as the North Koreans about not having another war?
Oh, South Koreans absolutely do not want to have another war. And President Moon stated very early on in his presidency that in opposition, frankly, to Mr. Trump, that South Korea will never, ever agree to a warlike position and preemptive or preventive strike by the United States that's not provoked by the North Koreans. For President Moon, peace on the peninsula is a cardinal rule. And if we think about the amount of economic activity on the peninsula in terms of South Korea's connection to Japan, China, Southeast Asia, Australia, the United States, if we think about the Asian stock markets and the trading system, risking war means not only risking hundreds of thousands of lives, both South Korean, American, and North Korean, potentially Chinese, but also risking economic havoc. And so I think Mr. Trump really needs to decide if he is going to play games and play up to his so-called base, a very small minority in the United States, by talking tough and talking unreasonably, frankly, or whether he's actually going to grab the problem of international insecurity by the horns and decide that he has to work, that the United States has to work constructively to prevent any kind of a military conflagration on the peninsula and to work toward creating a safer environment regarding North Korean missiles. You know, Mr. Trump actually gave his speech, his tough line speech about North Korea during the State of the Union while the Korean Peninsula and Asia were engulfed in the so-called peace talk, so-called improvements, efforts to improve inter-Korean relations. And I by no means believe that these efforts to improve inter-Korean relations are going to yield tangible fruits. But when Mr. Trump spoke the way he did about North Korea and paraded around a North Korean defector and, frankly, paraded the horribly saddened family of Otto Warmbier, the American student who had been detained in North Korea and came back to the U.S. in a coma and died, I think he just fell out of tune with what the rest of the world is hoping for, which is constructive engagement, principled constructive engagement to deal with this North Korean nuclear dilemma.
Gene Lee, back to you. Once again, you're in South Korea at the moment. What do you think about President Trump's relationship with President Moon of South Korea? The United States still doesn't have an ambassador to that country.
It's absolutely shocking that if this is your number one foreign policy or very important foreign policy priority, that you don't have an ambassador in the country. That sends a signal, certainly, but it perhaps suggests that there's a little bit of a disarray or disorder in the State Department or between the State Department and the White House.
Well, is it also is it insulting to South Korea?
It's very clear, you know, these two presidents have very different approaches on North Korea. Remember that President Moon is the son of North Korean refugees. His parents are from North Korea. So he has a different stake in this whole game, right? He said very clear that he wants to ensure and pave the way for the prosperity of all Korean people, North and South. And so that is very much at odds with an administration that seems sort of hell-bent on the destruction of the regime. So those are very different approaches and attitudes toward North Korea. And yet, really, the strongest thing that they could do is to remain united and show that they can't be divided. So this puts President Moon in a very tricky position. How does he carry out a policy of engagement and also being tough with North Korea while showing that he remains united with the United States, which is hinting that it might carry out or that it's considering a bloody nose strike or a military strike that could lead to the destruction of the Korean Peninsula. So it's difficult, and I think we've definitely been seeing the cracks in that alliance, and yet he understands that the strongest thing he can do is show that there's no daylight between them. So it's been an awkward dance, certainly.
Gene Lee speaking to us from South Korea. Catherine Moon, back to you. Have the South Koreans then, you indicated that they feel that Americans are arrogant, and this, particularly the younger generation. Of course, for many, many years, the United States military controlled the South Korean military. I think that was true up until 30 years ago or so. Has the honeymoon worn off? Are the South Koreans no longer as friendly, or as do they feel the same kind of gratitude toward the United States that they did at one point?
Well, I think you know, if we look at any set of countries, people change, nations change, and populations change. They grow. And so we can't possibly expect people in their teens and 20s and 30s today in America to be living with the mindset of people in the Mad Men category, the 1950s and 60s. Similarly, you can't expect South Koreans to be thinking about the Korean War and all that was lost and all that was gained after. Because they're living in a totally different time. I mean, my own students at Wellesley, for them, the Iraq War, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, is history. For me, it's not, but for them, it's history. And that's so recent. So I think it's unrealistic to expect young people to have that kind of a memory and almost a requirement for gratitude. It's outdated. But I also think that the Americans are not, they don't care enough about the history of the peninsula. The division is something that is a sore spot for not only North Koreans, but South Koreans, because they were artificially divided by U.S., two U.S. officials who within a 25-minute period drew a line on the map at the 38th parallel and said, voila, this is where we will divide the peninsula, and the Russians will manage the North, and the Americans will manage the South. And then that has ended up almost South Koreans fear and North Koreans fear in perpetuity. At the same time, South Korean youth do not have the fervor about unification, and Gene referred to this, that the older generation feels. And so we can't hold the young people guilty for not wanting to sacrifice their economic well-being and their political stability to unify a nation that they don't really feel that much kinship toward in terms of bringing the North Koreans into the South Korean fold or vice versa. And we can't expect them to be constantly bowing their heads to the Americans and saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, when they feel that they have earned their place in history. They have earned their place by working hard, by technologically getting the developing the advancement of technology and becoming a household name across the world. And through K-pop, the Korean wave in cinema, in film, in music, in dance, they feel that they have achieved what they've achieved on their own now.
Gene Lee, it's wonderful to hear about K-pop. When you were trying to establish the Associated Press Bureau in North Korea, I'm wondering what the cultural echoes were between the two countries. There are those who think that it was rock and roll that brought down the wall in Berlin.
So I did, during that period, Gangnam Style, which is that big hit song by the South Korean rapper, singer, performer Psy, was very popular. And so I did play it for the North Koreans. And I have to say, the response was, oh, it's kind of noisy. but they were actually, they told me, well, we're kind of proud of him. And that's a
What was it like to deal with those people?
Deal with the North Koreans?
The North Koreans, yeah.
Oh, that's a whole other conversation we could go. So I have to, you know, I am an ethnic Korean, and like Kathy, and so I don't look like the stereotypical American. You know, they are raised, it's part of their education to hate the American military. Kindergartens have a special room where they're educated about the alleged crimes committed by the Americans and by the Japanese, which were the two colonial powers, right, so to speak. But I don't look like those images. I'm not a tall Caucasian man with a crooked nose. They have a very terrible stereotype about Americans, but a caricature. But, you know, so it's my relationship was a little bit different. And I think that to some degree, because I did work with them day to day, they were very candid with me. So, of course, their responses, they gave me much more candid responses about the pop music. But one of the most interesting responses was, well, we're kind of proud of him, we're proud that a Korean got to number one. And I thought that was very interesting, that they were able to look beyond the division and the kind of propaganda. But that also indicates that they do feel that ethnic Koreans or South Koreans are their brethren. So it was interesting, certainly. I should point out that there is, you know, you mentioned rock and roll. They do... Some people do listen to American music, but much older music. They're not listening to hip-hop. They do show Disney cartoons on state TV in North Korea. And so that is probably the only sanctioned American pop culture. And so they are exposed in a way, to American culture through cartoons.
Is President Trump correct, though, when he describes the culture of North Korea as depraved? Is it as repressive as we hear again and again and again, and as we have heard for so long here in this country?
It is repressive in the sense that some of the basics of basic rights that we take for granted, the ability to express yourself, the ability to move around the country at your own will, these are all things that are very, very limited and restricted in North Korea. That said, the North Koreans do their best to live within these restrictions, but they have a very detailed and exhaustive penal code. It is very easy to break the law, and certainly the threat that you face when you are prosecuted or suspected of committing a crime is something that we have heard a bit about from defectors. And so it is a difficult place to live, not just because of the surveillance and the kind of repressiveness, but also just because they have a lack of food, a lack of energy. But they do the best that they can in that situation. They certainly have certain coping mechanisms. I do always try to highlight that they are human beings, and that sometimes what we see in our media is not quite what you experience when you're there on the ground.
Very quickly, Catherine Moon, what about the sister of Kim Jong-un, Kim Yo-jung? How important was it that she was sent to South Korea to make the invitation to President Moon that he visit the North, and how soon do you think he might do it?
I think of all the developments in this negotiation and efforts at bringing the North Koreans to South Korea, the North Koreans choosing Kim Yo-jung, the sister of Kim Jong-un, to me was the most interesting. It was the most unexpected. People talked about it. I wasn't sure that would actually happen. And it's interesting because, number one, Kim Jong-un, the leader, trusts his sister, and she is ever faithful to him. And what's really ironic is that in Pyeongchang, she became the star. She was in the spotlight, and the whole world looked upon her, and she stepped up. At home in North Korea, she is behind the scenes, literally behind pillars, behind drapes, just to make sure that things are running smoothly for her brother, but that the brother gets all of the spotlight, limelight. So this was her coming out party, not only to the world, but actually to North Koreans, because the North Korean media has been broadcasting images of her in South Korea and how well she was received. So I think that's very important. The other aspect is that she is a trusted advisor and a confidant, and she actually gave the only deliverable out of this whole hoopla of a month of planning. I mean, everything else was a show, but she actually delivered an actual invitation to President Moon Jae-in of South Korea to join her brother at an official summit meeting in Pyongyang. And that invitation came from Kim Jong-un. So she served as an official emissary. In that sense, she delivered the most important punchline.
Jean Lee, will we hear more from her?
I agree with Kathy, absolutely. And I think she makes a great point in calling this Kim Yo-jung's debut, not just to us, right? This is the first time we've really gotten a good look at her, but also to the North Korean people. And that's significant as well, because these are all very calculated steps to reveal to the North Korean people themselves what the power structure is, who's going to be in power. And this, in a way, was Kim Jong-un giving her the opportunity to shine and telling his people, she's going to be important. You need to watch out for her. So absolutely an important point for Kathy to underline, and I'm glad that she put that into context. We will be seeing more of her. We did know that her role was really to lionize her big brother. This is a role that Kim Jong-il had for his father, Kim Il-sung. And so it's an indication for those of us who watch these things very closely that she is in that inner circle and is going to occupy an important place in the leadership.
So, Catherine Moon, tell us a little bit more, if you will, from your standpoint about Kim Yo-jung and the comparisons that have been made to another very famous woman.
Well, some people in the media have been calling Kim Yo-jung the North Korean Ivanka, that is, a relative of the top leader, without an official portfolio, who is there to soften things up. But I have to say, she is far from Ivanka Trump in this sense. Yes, they both come from, in a sense, a dynastic line, privileged line. But Kim Yo-jung actually has been trained. She started out as a lower-level cadre in the Korea Workers' Party, and she has served in the North Korean bureaucracy for many, many years, starting in the early 2000s when she was only in her 20s. And this woman has climbed up in the ranks. So she is much more experienced than Ivanka and her brother Kim Jong-un, frankly, who did not get that kind of training. And funnily enough, her father, Kim Jong-il, actually told a foreign visitor, a Russian dignitary, years and years ago, introducing her daughter when she was very young and saying that this is the one of my children. This is the child who has the political capacity to take over. So we will see what happens.
Wow. Jean Lee, any gloss on that?
I think that's fascinating. So some people have asked me, is it possible that we could have a future woman leader of North Korea? And I think it's absolutely possible. I don't know if it would be Kim Yo-jung or perhaps one of Kim Jong-un's children. We know his eldest, one of his children is a daughter. But, you know, as long as you are descended from that Baekdu bloodline, you are descended from Kim Il-sung, you have the right to rule North Korea. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the decades to come.
Jean Lee and Catherine Moon, thanks to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrea Brody and Devin Schwartz produced this podcast. Our engineer is Joel Stein. I'm Armin Alney. To the Point is available on Apple Podcasts, other podcast forums, and at kcrw.com/To the Point. Join us again and again.